From Arkansas to South Carolina, Kansas to New Jersey, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan dissolved into chaos as that country fell back under Taliban control. James Carafano of the Heritage Foundation is here to discuss the impact. Congress is set to return to session, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is going to queue up passage of massive spending bills. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The U.S. Postal Service has a social media tracking program. Is Big Brother watching you? Eric Boehm and Liz Nolan Brown of Reason Magazine have the answer. And the elusive goal of racial reconciliation cannot be achieved by the political left. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA tells us who can get the job done on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Conjuring up memories of the fall of Saigon, horrifying images of chaos in Afghanistan accompanied the collapse of the American-backed government and the return to power of the Taliban. Here with a look at what went wrong and the impact is James Carafano. He is Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Jim, before we get into some of the particulars, one of the big questions that has arisen as Americans have witnessed the horror of what has occurred in Afghanistan over the last week or so, was this inevitable or would it have been possible for America to have gotten out in a more organized fashion?
I don't know if we could have gotten out in a more organized fashion. Even if we had, we would still have the same problems to worry about: the resurgence of terrorism, the 100,000-plus refugees and foreigners trying to leave the country, the entry of China and other countries in there. So the problems wouldn't have been any different. The alternative question is what would have happened if we had just stayed? You know, we had 2,500 troops, far less than we have in other parts of the world. They hadn't taken a casualty in a year and a half. We were spending less in a year than we used to spend in a week. And we had basically created a status quo that held the Taliban to a standstill. The economy was growing. Women were going to work. Children were going to school. So, you know, people could talk about endless wars and everything else all they want. But the reality was is Afghanistan was far better off and it was far cheaper for us. Even if you look at the cost of leaving, the tens of billions of dollars of equipment that we lost, the bases, we sent in way more troops than what were there, and the cost of evacuation is astronomical. So it would have been cheaper and more stable just to keep doing what we were doing.
And that was, of course, the Trump policy. President Biden, in his speech last week, basically blamed President Trump for everything that has occurred. Was that really an accurate assessment of what has happened here?
No, I think, you know, President Biden really created two problems for himself. He already had a strategic problem, and he, I think, laid on a political problem by making the speech all about him and saying he did nothing wrong. Essentially, now it's a referendum on his decision-making, and I think he has no legitimacy here. Trump's plan was not to run away. Trump would never have stood by and been humiliated by the Taliban. This was the president's decision against the advice of the military and the intelligence community. And to say, well, the decision had been made for me, well, President Biden reversed virtually every decision President Trump made, from Keystone XL to border security. And I don't think it's clear to anybody why he could reverse all those decisions. But if he thinks Trump's Afghan policy was wrong, why he was forced to follow through on it, that makes no sense.
Looking ahead now, we have a situation where the Taliban back in control in Afghanistan. Is it reasonable for Americans and others around the world, Jim, to fear that this is going to allow terrorists to reestablish themselves in that country and then export terrorism to America and globally?
Well, two things. First of all, I think we have to be worried about a false dawn. I mean, there are already people who are trying to normalize the Taliban, saying, oh, look, they're not so bad. And really are trying to cushion the criticism of President Biden. And the Taliban are exacerbating this by saying, oh, we're going to respect human rights, which is a meaningless claim. But we have three problems, which I think will plague President throughout his term of office. One is, of course, the refugee crisis. Even if the Taliban don't interfere and everything goes perfect, that's going to drag on for days, probably weeks. We'll have a transnational terrorist threat. There will be a terrorist sanctuary in Afghanistan, which is where 9/11 is planned, which where the next 9/11 could be planned. And in addition to that, the Taliban victory will be a clarion call to transnational terrorists all over the world. And so 30 days ago, we really didn't have a global transnational terrorist problem. In a few weeks or months, we could well have one again. And then there's another problem on top of that, which is President Biden has essentially gifted Afghanistan to China. The Chinese work with the Taliban, they don't have a problem with that. They'll build a bridge to Iran. If Biden does the Iran deal, they'll have their own private corridor of across Europe by bypassing everybody into Western Europe. They'll make trillions of dollars off of that. They'll control Afghans' mineral resources, which are extensive. They'll be able to outflank and isolate India. They may control all of South Asia. These are problems that will continue to hammer at the Biden presidency the whole rest of his term.
Does this now give the terrorists that you referenced a very powerful recruiting tool here, Jim? You saw what happened in Afghanistan. Is the message now, if we just hang in there long enough, America will give up?
Well, I think we can just learn from history. I mean, look what happened in Iraq. When we walked away from Iraq, which again was a stable situation, you had the explosion of ISIS, and literally tens of thousands of foreign fighters poured into Iraq and created a new global concern. And we don't know exactly what is going to happen, but it would be foolish not to at least plan for the contingency of a resurgence of global terrorism after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Joe Biden and the Democrats, of course, have made a big deal out of the fact that he has all these foreign policy credentials and experience from all of his years in Congress and as vice president. This situation in Afghanistan, did the president consult with our NATO allies and others around the world before taking this action that triggered the downfall of Afghanistan?
No, we didn't. And despite the president's promise that America's back and we're going to work with allies and we're going to consult, he didn't do any of that. They were all just told what we were going to do and had no time to do their own plans to respond to it. Look, I think you get to the real problem here. This is not a rookie team making rookie mistakes. The president and virtually every member of his team are veterans of foreign policy from the Obama administration. They dealt with multiple crises from Iraq and ISIS, Syria and the Red Line, Libya and Benghazi. They've had a lot of experience doing this. And to be honest, usually they were bad. And if anything, all this shows is they're consistent. The hallmark of Biden-Obama foreign, I don't mean it's a political crisis, it's not, it's just looking at history. The hallmark of the Biden-Obama foreign policy is weakness and, quite frankly, cowardice. Looking for the easy way out and just hoping things don't go wrong, not having a plan if they do, and wind up costing America and Americans' pride and American money and treasure and security way more risks than if literally if they had just sat in office and done nothing.
Taking what you just said and looking forward, Jim, how does America now go and get engaged in other parts of the world? What about our credibility? Do we still have credibility? Is this now projecting weakness where not only China but Putin and others are going to take advantage of the situation?
Well, I think America, when everybody looks at America, it is still a great and powerful country. And we are a country that's demonstrated that when we regain our heart and soul and courage, we are a formidable foe to anybody. So I don't think anybody will take America for a patsy, but they have seen the Obama-Biden playbook. They know how to play that. They will continue to look for opportunities to take advantage of us. There's no question about that.
We have been talking with Jim Carafano, who is Vice President for Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation, based, of course, in Washington, D.C. Jim, before you go, tell us a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. Also, you have written a number of articles over this past week. Where can folks find them?
The Heritage is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research institution. We look for ideas to keep America free, safe, and prosperous, and we work really hard with like-minded Americans to try to do that, to do the best we can for our country. We're completely donor-funded, mostly by small individuals. All of our work is completely transparent, and it's all available online at heritage.org.
Jim Carafano from the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thank you for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the offices of the Club for Growth. He, of course, does keep an eye on everything on Capitol Hill. But as we've just talked about with Jim Carafano, a lot of eyes are on Afghanistan. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Scott, your thoughts on the impact of the whole debacle in Afghanistan on Joe Biden's political standing and questions about his leadership
whenever we have a major foreign policy crisis, it can certainly hijack the political debate and the policy debate within Washington. We know that Congress has received some classified briefings over the last few days, and then they've also had conference-wide and caucus-wide phone calls between the parties that have basically indicated that we knew that Biden, what he said in his original press conference on July 8th, was a bunch of sort of hogwash, I guess is what I would call it. The fact that the Taliban was able to take over so quickly and how we saw the collapse of really the Afghani National Army that the U.S. troops had trained for 20 years just really give up and trade sides that quickly. It shows what the presence of U.S. forces really means in terms of stability in a region. So now that there's all that instability, I do think that it can dominate the political discourse here in Washington over the coming months. Obviously, the situation on the ground will play into how loud that debate becomes. But this week, we saw Joe Biden sit down with George Stephanopoulos of ABC News, and that interview is being played on every station right now. And the bottom line is, I think that Joe Biden is losing a lot of members of the media that are typically friendly to a Democrat president, but understand that his leadership has failed throughout the past week.
It is indeed a tragic and sad situation as the president attempts to spin his way out of this, which this time around, not likely to happen. Let us talk, however, about the fact that the U.S. House of Representatives is going to be coming back into Washington next week. There are a lot of items on the agenda. Tell us how this is going to unfold over the next few days, Scott.
So this is a little bit tricky to explain, but the bottom line is, Pelosi has called back the House of Representatives to reconvene on August 23rd. Generally speaking, the month of August is used in the congressional districts to do different constituent meetings, to do parades, a little bit of downtime. Typically, this is when members actually take vacation. And so we saw the Senate pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill, I think it was on August 10th. And now you've got the House of Representatives that are trying to determine how exactly they're going to proceed. After the Senate passed that bipartisan infrastructure package, they brought up a partisan budget resolution, which is basically the key to unlock the $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill that we've talked about a couple of times on your program. And so on Monday, the 23rd, or possibly on the 24th, we expect Nancy Pelosi to bring forward in the House what's called a rule bill. And that rule bill would provide for basically continuing the process on three different major pieces of legislation. The first one would be the bipartisan infrastructure package. The second one would be the Senate-passed budget resolution that allows for consideration on reconciliation. And then the third piece of legislation is H.R. 4, the John Lewis civil rights legislation and voting rights. And so when you combine all three of those, it basically means that they can continue the process of full consideration on the House floor. I would expect that to be what's known as a closed rule, meaning they're going to try to jam it through as quickly as possible. But the bottom line is, they'll spend some time on H.R. 4, just passing that likely on a partisan vote throughout the House. Pelosi will not allow for final passage of the bipartisan infrastructure package until the House receives a Senate-passed reconciliation bill. So what I think we'll see this week is Nancy Pelosi passing that budget resolution and allowing basically the Senate to continue its effort in terms of passing a $3.5 trillion package. Eventually, that'll be ping-ponged back over to the House, and then we'll see basically unknown levels of spending. Basically, we're allowing for the authorization of $3.5 trillion. Does Joe Manchin try to negotiate that lower? What do the tax increases look like? How's this paid for? There's a whole lot of questions surrounding the actual details of the legislation. But I still expect September to be consideration of the continuing resolution to fund government through the month of December, and also to determine what Congress is going to do in relation to a debt limit increase.
Nancy Pelosi, of course, is having difficulty keeping all the left wing of her party in line. And as you mentioned, Joe Manchin, sometimes Kyrsten Sinema, they're not necessarily in line with everybody else in the Senate. So is there a possibility here, Scott, the Democrats might not be able to get their own act together to shove this through on a partisan line vote?
There is a possibility. There were 9 House Democrats that sent a letter to Nancy Pelosi saying that they wanted to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill before they would consider the reconciliation package. But then on the other side of the aisle, you've got the socialist squad and sort of the radical progressive wing of the Democratic caucus that is saying heck no to the bipartisan bill before they get consideration of the $3.5 trillion reconciliation tax and spend Green New Deal bill. And so in the Senate, you've got similar pressure points between folks like Bernie Sanders and Jeff Merkley and Elizabeth Warren, and then some of the moderates like Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin and John Tester. So it's always interesting to see how the Democrats are able to pull together unity within the Democratic caucus in the House and Senate. I certainly think it's something worth paying close attention to. There aren't going to be a whole lot of Republican votes out there to help the Democrats this time, but we obviously did see 19 Senate Republicans join forces with every single Senate Democrat in passing that $1.2 trillion infrastructure package on August 10th.
Are those 19 Republicans likely to go along with a $3.5 trillion massive spending bill?
I would be shocked if a single one of them went along with it. I think that they would probably be booted from the Republican Party if they did that. But that's what reconciliation allows for. It allows for a partisan effort to go forward without input from the other side. Typically, it's supposed to be related to revenues and spending. This is why the controversy surrounding the Senate precedent on the Byrd Rule, meaning what is considered allowed on reconciliation through the Senate parliamentarian, that'll always come into play. And it could narrow a bill down significantly in size and scope as pieces of the legislation fail that test.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth, and of course, we'll be chatting with him every week as we go through this process. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C., united around this idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. And you can actually become a member of the Club for Growth for free at clubforgrowth.org. Check us out. Join 525,000 other Americans in uniting behind these ideas of economic liberty.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
The United States Postal Service has a secret social media tracking program. Are they watching you? We turn to Eric Boehm and Liz Nolan Brown of Reason Magazine for the answer.
There's a semi-secret, somewhat covert government program called the Internet Covert Operations Program, ICOP, because everything in Washington has to have a clever little acronym. And you might think that something with a name like that would be run by the FBI or the CIA or the Department of Homeland Security. It's not. It's run by the Postal Service. And my guest today will explain, or try to explain, why that's the case. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Liz Nolan Brown. She is a senior editor at Reason Magazine, a colleague of mine, and she's been following this story for a few months now, culminating ultimately in a piece that she wrote for the magazine last month, the USPS's Semi-Secret Internet Surveillance Apparatus. You can find that at Reason.com. Liz, thanks for taking some time and joining us today.
Yeah, hi, Eric. How's it going?
It's going all right. This is a piece that you wrote for Reason a couple of months ago, actually, the USPS's Semi-Secret Internet Surveillance Apparatus. The agency, best known for delivering the mail, has a side hustle in online snooping. Why is the Postal Service looking at my tweets?
That is a good question, and that is one no one has actually quite figured out yet. We know now about the existence of this program, but not why the post office is doing it. Yahoo News actually first reported on this back in the spring, and they, you know, said that they got a bulletin that the U.S. Postal Inspection Service sent out to Homeland Security fusion centers and other law enforcement agencies about how they were monitoring Twitter and Facebook and Parler about looking for protest information about protesters and planned protests. And especially there was some, like, rally for peace and freedom or something it was called, and that was what they were especially spying on in this one bulletin and reporting on. Since then, more has been revealed about it a little bit because Congress hauled the postal inspector before them and asked questions, and they found out that they had been, you know, sharing this information with law enforcement, and that this program had morphed from a drug surveillance program into monitoring protesters. But why exactly the post office is doing this as opposed to, I mean, hopefully no one would be doing it, but, you know, if someone's going to do it, then why isn't it a more traditional agency that deals with intelligence? No one is really quite sure.
I guess on one hand, maybe I'm glad the post office is doing it because it means that, like, they'll just be really slow at delivering any of the information maybe to the other intelligence agencies. I mean, you've covered this, you've covered these sorts of things before and quite extensively for a reason. And so I want to kind of drill down on the thing you said there about how this started as being an investigation or started being a program that was meant to investigate like drug crimes, and now it's being used for other things. I mean, this is like an ongoing trend that we see, particularly with federal law enforcement, right? That like it's either terrorism or drugs, and then it becomes about, you know, well, protests for freedom and peace.
Yeah, I mean, this is very classic. And again, drugs and guns, they said they were originally monitoring for. And I don't know what the post office hoped to learn by, like, looking at tweets. Like, are there people out there that are like, hey, just mailed some illegal guns, hope you get them soon or something, you know? I don't understand. But the fact that this was supposed to be at least, yes, a program dealing with illegal activity that sort of morphed into a thing that just is, looks like it's targeting, you know, like First Amendment rights and free speech and things is very classic with these sorts of programs.
We're talking with Elizabeth Nolan Brown. She's a senior editor for Reason Magazine, a colleague of mine. Her piece in one of the latest editions of Reason Magazine, the USPS's semi-secret internet surveillance apparatus, this ICOP program that the Postal Service runs. Liz, just a minute or so left here. You mentioned that Congress, after this became somewhat public, Congress hauled the post office in front of them for some questions about what exactly they were doing. I don't have much hope that Congress will ever rein in any of these like security and surveillance programs that we have running. But is there some hope here? Give me some hope.
No, I mean, well, not from Congress. They mostly sort of seem to do it as a show trial like anything else that they do, where they could just, you know, get up there and say their piece about how this was, because Republicans were revealed as being spied on. There was a lot of Republican legislators that just wanted to be like, how dare you? But like, probably wouldn't have cared, you know, if this was revealed to be spied on leftists. But the good news is that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has filed a FOIA lawsuit. They'd filed FOIA requests and the program refused to respond. So now they've actually filed a lawsuit in court to get more information about what exactly is being collected, why it's being collected, how the information is being stored and shared, and things like that. So hopefully we will learn some more about this program and whether or not it's something, you know, that we really need to rein in and be worried about.
So more to come on this story, and you can find that when it all comes out into the open at Reason.com. Liz, thanks for taking some time with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And again, that's Liz Nolan Brown, senior editor at Reason Magazine. You can find her work, find my work, find everything else that we're working on at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Racial reconciliation cannot be achieved by the American left, but there is one Republican in particular who can have a big impact. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA tells us who on this American Radio Journal commentary.
If you want to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem of racial conflict in America, then I invite you to take a fresh look at it. I'm going to propose something that may sound counterintuitive at first, but if you're willing to look at an old problem from a new angle, you just might find a new solution. Since the 1960s and 70s, the issue of race, especially addressing racism directed at black Americans, has been a political cause championed primarily by liberals, later called progressives, and the Democrat Party. After the successful execution of the so-called Southern Strategy by Richard Nixon, many of the anachronistic remnants of segregation migrated from the Democrat Party to the Republican Party. This put the party of Lincoln and Frederick Douglass at odds with its own history on one side, while on the other side, the party of segregation, Jim Crow, and the opponents of Reconstruction repositioned itself as the party leading the civil rights movement. In the 50-plus years since, The Democrat Party has elected many more black candidates than has the Republican Party, including one president. But serious racial reconciliation remains out of reach. The polarization that has lately evidenced itself in the contention over the promotion of critical race theory in our schools is a perfect example of why the political left will never bring us together into racial harmony. The left will insist on vilifying and demonizing all those who disagree with their radical revisionism of American history and the legacy of its founders. Pride in American ideals and values, as expressed in the Declaration of Independence, is rejected as irretrievably corrupt, patriarchal, and racist. Isn't that ironic? They want to apply the very same dehumanizing tropes of slavery to the anti-racism movement. Politically, there can be no compromise, thus no bipartisanship, short of the most humiliating capitulation. Is it any wonder that such an approach to societal divisions has not worked and will never work? Instead of bringing our beloved but divided nation together, the left employs a scorched earth policy that will never achieve social harmony. So what's the resolution of this dilemma? Well, just as Nixon could go to China but Johnson could not, so I posit that racial reconciliation will never succeed if led from the left. It can only succeed if it is led from the right. Not only does that leadership need to come from conservatives and or Republicans, it ideally should come from black conservatives. The late black economist Walter Williams understood this. So do columnist Jason Riley, radio host Larry Elder, Bishop Harry Jackson, and Senator Tim Scott, each in their respective spheres of influence. As the only black Republican senator, Tim Scott can reset the table politically. If he were to run for president and be elected, he could do what Barack Obama was unable to do. Unlike the left's approach to reconciliation, their scorched earth policy, Scott would never, and frankly could never, demand the humiliating groveling that's naturally at the heart of the other side's strategy. He'd probably build his strategy on that of Frederick Douglass, a fellow Republican who endured much worse racism than is now extant, and who acknowledged that the ideal of equality as expressed in the Declaration was not the reality of his time, but that it should be held up and worked towards, rather than rejected as hopelessly hypocritical. Any demagogue can inflame passions and drive people apart. Only true, idealistic, and selfless leadership can bring them together. What America needs now is not critical race theory, which is inherently divisive. What we need now, more than ever, is critical thinking and servant leadership modeled after Jesus Christ. Tim Scott is not the only leader who possesses these qualities, but he may be the one with the highest profile. Please get to know him. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WGGC-FM in Bowling Green, Kentucky, WMNZ-AM at Montezuma State in Georgia, and WQFX-FM in Biloxi, Mississippi. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.